Hello there. You are listening to Stems and Leaves. This is a show where we discuss intersectional stories in STEM, or we at least ponder life adjacent to and after STEM. My name is Ezra. I am the creator and host of Stems and Leaves, and in this episode, I am actually re-recording some content that I published a few years ago. In 2020, following the murder of George Floyd, in the first few months of the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a lot of intense discussion in my community about what restorative justice looks like for marginalized groups in our city. I was inspired to create that episode to explore some of the historic instigators of spatial segregation. Spatial segregation, which in turn drives the disparities in wealth, social, and health outcomes for different Columbus residents based on the color of their skin. So I wrote that episode 2 years ago, and since then, through both my research and my experiences as a city planning student and my experiences as a community organizer, I feel like I've gained a bigger and broader understanding of some of these social and environmental injustice issues that are happening in Columbus, and I feel like I'm better equipped now to talk about them than I was maybe 2 years ago. So that's what this episode is. We are going to be talking about Columbus, Ohio's legacy of racism in urban planning. And before I step into a bit more context about Columbus's urban issues, I do want to take some time to elevate a few local organizations that are doing the hard work of restorative justice in Columbus. I will be including these links on stemsandleaves.com on this episode's post for you to learn more about all of these groups. In no particular order, you should look into BQIC, that is Black Queer Intersectional Collective Ohio, Columbus Freedom Coalition, Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice, and BREAD, Building Respect, Equity, and Dignity. These groups, among many others, are all really incredible sources of community support. During the protests in 2020, they all organized supplies and medical care, afterwards engaging in conversations with civic leaders and with the public to help unpack and understand what was occurring. They dedicated time to creating, you know, learning opportunities and educational resources. All of those groups were really great. So if you are able to, I would really encourage you to share your time and your resources to continue supporting mutual aid in our community. Columbus, Ohio is in many ways the poster child for what city planning did to the northern United States. Columbus has always been Test City America. If it works in Columbus, it'll work anywhere. And in this case, a lot of the actions that were taken in the realm of city planning were part of a greater and more nefarious system. In city planning, the very footprint of our city, the way it is laid out, designed, where things are zoned, all of this is influenced by city planning, which itself is influenced by systemic racism. Which is to say that since its origin as a practice, city and regional planning is an agent that was created by a racist system to ensure the protection of those systems and its beneficiaries. So in this case, in Columbus, city planners used all sorts of different means and methods to spatially segregate Black residents from white residents, segregate lower-income residents from higher-income. It is not a mistake. It is not an accident. It is a system working very well at what it was designed to do. And so I know this might come off a little bit strong to some of my listeners. If you don't have a lot of study around environmental justice, or if you don't have direct lived experience of some of these things I'm talking about, this might all sound sort of unreal. It might sound like I'm sort of making things sound a little too intense. Maybe you think it's not that big of a problem, but let's keep chatting about this, and I'll explain a bit more about what I mean when I say Columbus has a racist legacy. So to set the stage, I do want to tell you a little bit more about Columbus, Ohio, for those that aren't familiar. Columbus is the capital city of Ohio, being the 7th most populous state in the United States. The metropolitan area includes about 2 million residents. In the 2010 census, our population was reported to be about 61% white, around 28% Black or African American, and then Hispanic, Asian, and other populations rounded out that last 10%. So Columbus is very diverse compared to state or national demographic averages. However, with this diversity comes a lot of hardships. In 2015, Columbus was named the 2nd most economically segregated city in the U.S. This rating came out of a study by the University of Toronto, where they looked at cities and the concentrations of income, occupation, and education level. They provided rankings for, I think, almost 200 or over 200 North American cities, and it made for some really interesting headlines a few years ago. Local papers like the Columbus Dispatch chalked it up to, you know, certain facets of city planning that people might be more familiar with. We're talking about restrictive covenants or redlining, zoning regulations, white flight. If any of those things aren't familiar to you, just roll with me for a bit. We don't have to get into all of the different mechanisms and forces that the city's used. But it is important to know that there are a lot of different ways that Columbus was able to perpetuate racism in the built environment. And the one way that I want to talk about in this episode specifically is redlining. To tell you the history of redlining in Columbus, you will also need to recall the broader social and cultural phenomena that were happening. So going back just shy of 100 years, when we were between the two world wars, the U.S. was facing a huge economic crisis and a mass housing shortage. So the federal government wanted to increase housing stock, and they introduced the National Housing Act of 1934. It was signed by President Roosevelt with the intention of improving housing conditions, making housing and mortgages more accessible, and to reduce the foreclosure rate that was happening during the Great Depression. And all of this was packaged as part of President Roosevelt's New Deal, if you recall that from your high school history class. So essentially, this Housing Act made way for programs to identify the desirability of real estate for investment as American cities, especially in the North, continued to grow. The Homeowners Loan Corporation, or the HOLC, was the entity that drew up the maps that we ultimately know as the redlining maps. They evaluated more than 200 cities and created residential security maps. These maps marked areas as either Type A, being the most desirable for investment, Type B, still desirable, Type C, declining neighborhoods, and Type D, were redlined neighborhoods, which were the most risky. So using these maps, investors were able to decide where they wanted to put their money, and where they wanted to support home mortgages and business loans, etc. For the most part, Type A neighborhoods tended to be new development that were primarily white and primarily middle and upper class. At the same time that these communities were being invested in, minority communities and Black neighborhoods were facing disinvestment. And what the qualifications were for an unsuitable neighborhood were sort of subjective, and more often than not, neighborhoods were redlined because of their demographic makeup rather than their actual real estate value. So these practices over decades uplifted white, middle and lower class Americans, allowing them greater economic and social mobility, while Black and minority neighborhoods continued to face tremendous trauma. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, white folks could point to a green neighborhood on a map with a high degree of confidence that they would probably be able to get approved for that home loan, where a Black resident in Columbus during this time probably wouldn't even be able to get a loan for their own neighborhood that was redlined, let alone even think about moving to a neighborhood like Upper Arlington or Clintonville, where restrictive covenants made it essentially impossible for Black people to live there. In Columbus, our redlined neighborhoods were the areas where present-day Franklinton, Near East Side, and South Linden, with a few others, reside. This is not exhaustive, of course. But Columbus locals will know that those are predominantly Black neighborhoods and that they have survived several decades of social and economic turmoil. These neighborhoods were redlined on those HOLC maps. If you want to look at them, go ahead over to engagingcolumbus.owu.edu. This is a resource that I found and has been a great tool in communicating, you know, the history of Columbus. They overlay these HOLC maps with other historic and even modern demographic maps to see how these spatial patterns emerge. So the consequences of policies and practices like redlining extend really far into all aspects of life. In Columbus, there's all sorts of data to prove this point, but as a few examples, in Columbus, there is as much as a 20-year gap in life expectancy between zip codes. So in Hilltop, the average life expectancy is 61.8. The state average life expectancy is 77.8. So that's more than 15 years. More than 15 years just for being in a different zip code. In a study by the Kirwan Institute on infant mortality, they identified several hot spots where they measured more than 10 infant deaths per square mile. I dare you to guess which neighborhoods those ended up being. Significant parts of them were in Franklinton, Near East Side, and parts of Linden. Similar stats are reported for these areas for all sorts of chronic diseases and health conditions. Asthma and COPD are nearly double the rate in Black neighborhoods in Columbus as compared to their predominantly white counterparts. In a geoscience class I took a few semesters ago, we analyzed the density of urban tree cover. And it is well documented that public green spaces and dense urban trees are huge factors in healthy lifestyles for neighborhood residents. More trees keep streets physically cooler, they promote safety and comfort. Neighborhoods like Clintonville and Victorian Village have old, dense tree growth, and they are well known for that. They're well known for being walkable, having access to amenities like grocery stores and restaurants, libraries, bars, parks. Health outcomes are directly correlated to people's environment, and some environments have been designed to deprive. Columbus knows this. It's evident in its urban forestry master plan and its public health plans. But when we talk about issues like food deserts and nutrition, infant mortality and maternal health, asthma and COPD, all of these outcomes are the direct result of environmental racism. And the fact is that most urban planning practices are intended to maintain the status quo and prevent social and economic mobility of Black and minority citizens. These big problems that we talk about in planning are all just supporting pillars in a system that was specifically created and relies upon the suppression of Black people for the benefit of white people. The lived experiences of people in these neighborhoods in Columbus is not a mistake. They were strategically disregarded, denied, and forced to disproportionately bear the burden. For people that are working in planning, if you do not already understand that you are working in a system that has been built on the successful isolation, disinvestment, and disenfranchisement of Black communities, I would really encourage you to do some research. I would invite you to start with The Color of Law, a book by Richard Rothstein. It unpacks the history of segregation in major American cities and how it has manifested in the abuse of Black Americans. It is a well-written assessment of redlining and some of the greater context of systemic racism. So if you want this episode, but like way more researched and written and like 300 pages, definitely go check that out. I'm also going to plug another piece, which is a research paper that I wrote a few semesters ago. This piece is called Preservation or Platitude. It is a paper on Flytown, which is a neighborhood in Columbus that no longer exists. It was erased in the 1950s in light of urban renewal and highway expansion. I spent a lot of time pulling from so many resources in our historic archive. I had all sorts of people help me, and so if nothing else, please just like go scroll through and look at the pretty images, because it's an important story that I feel moved to share. Additionally, if you are ready to engage your curiosity, you might want to take a deeper dive on a reading list that was recommended to me by Dr. Ettlinger of OSU. It is the Communication So White reading syllabus. It is a collaborative reading list with resources that are assembled to help marginalized people address and dismantle barriers and to help people in positions of power and authority do the same. It is a really comprehensive and great resource with notes on issues like white supremacy, colonialism, ableism, feminism, etc. All of that will be linked at stemsandleaves.com. And again, if you are local to Columbus, I would highly recommend you look into BREAD. That is Building Respect, Equity, and Dignity. They are a coalition of over 40 interfaith congregations that do work around social justice in Columbus. They are associated with the DART Center. I've recently gotten involved with their environmental justice group, and I've been able to help provide some research and help get some numbers to bring to civic leaders in our conversations, and it has been very wonderful and very fulfilling to be part of that work. Thank you for being with me for this episode today. That is all I have the energy for. I hope you learned something and that you tap into some of the resources that I've shared. There were a few other things that were cut for time from this version of the episode that I still will link for you to peruse. It includes several wonderful Black women planners in North America that are engaging in conversations similar to this that are really awesome, so you'll want to check those out. Stems and Leaves is grateful to Rosie Ross for the use of our theme song, Feeling Fool, and to Aaron Thomas Art for our cover art. This is Stems and Leaves. I am Ezra. Stay curious.